I thought I would make some observations. I thought I'd get to the heart of the matter, which is the questions around motivations and key objectives of what has been proposed and then signed, and what the ramifications are from here. So, and in doing that, I'll start with a reference to our own region in the Illawarra on the South Coast. As the Secretary of the South Coast Labor Council, my first job is to be a voice for working people and the working class on the South Coast of New South Wales. And as I point out to some, very few these days as this progresses and people understand the ramifications, I don't have to explain why, but to those who ask, I simply say this, that the phrase peace is union business is not new. It has been born out of the very tragic events throughout our history where the blood of the working class is spilt at the altar of imperialism. And in our region, which includes the port of Port Kembla, it has a special significance, given that it was the site of one of the most significant, internationally significant struggles against that imperialism and the struggle against fascism prior to World War II, when in 1938, a very brave and principled group of workers under the Waterside Workers banner and their union refused to load pig iron that was bound for Japan in 1938 because it was bound for the military industrial complex, if we use those terms these days, of the emerging imperial power in Japan, its annexation of China, and in particular Manchuria, and the misery and the thousands and thousands of deaths and atrocities that were committed there. I say this as a prelude to what I'm about to say so that you can get an understanding of the disbelief and concern and frankly sense of outrage that in a place like this in Port Kembla, where those wharfies stood up to the imperialism and fired the first shots in an undeclared war against fascism, that this should be the port that the military establishment should favour to base a staging post for the US Navy to start the next and possibly final conflict. Port Kembla holds its place high in the union movement, in the working class, and in the international movement for peace. Every year on the 15th of November, Dalfram Day, we acknowledge, commemorate and celebrate those events when a group of wharfies, backed in by the entire union movement and the stood down steel workers over Christmas who refused to cross the picket lines, and then the working class of the entire country who pitched in and realised what was at stake, taught Bob Menzies, to be then known as Pig Iron Bob thereafter, a lesson, taught him a lesson that the working class that is expected to spill their blood to defend the interests of the imperialists demanded a seat at the table of foreign policy. We jump to recent developments in AUKUS. And let me play back to you the events as we saw them. When we woke to the news one morning that the then Prime Minister Scott Morrison had this brain bubble, thought bubble, that he was going to set up an alliance called AUKUS, many people laughed. Those of us that have seen some of these things before knew that these are not the creations of a madman. These things are the designs of superpowers. It is no accident that this, from the moment it was announced as an idea, quickly became a reality. And the then opposition leader, we are told, was given 24 hours to sign or be forever wedged in a forthcoming election. Those events now are fairly well known, as is the disbelief that it was committed to, they say, within those 24 hours. What is not recognised is the work that was done beforehand, and the notion that the United States Navy, government, military industrial complex would ever let an Australian Prime Minister dictate an agreement like AUKUS between three countries is so absurd that it's not funny. It's not even a joke, let alone a fool like Morrison. No one really believes that. And now, of course, we realise that this was years in the planning, and the moment was not chosen by Morrison so much as by the puppeteers. Because in that moment, they locked in the current and future Prime Minister of Australia and their respective governments. If you were a bookie, you couldn't take odds on that one. They secured both options in one hit. Many of us suspected that the soon-to-become Prime Minister would find some way of wriggling out of this situation. What we call exit ramps, politely these days, were plenty to be found. The cost, the detail, the implications, the time frame, the stupidity of it. There were numerous ways in which it could have been done. If not in one hit, then certainly in a few rounds at least. But what we got instead in San Diego was a doubling down of the strategy and a further commitment with a price tag that would be paid for by the working class in this country. That was something that had surprised even seasoned observers as to how far the dignity of a government and a country could slide so quickly in those moments. What happened 2 days beforehand was not well known and didn't become relevant till much later. You see, 2 days before that announcement in San Diego, before the deal was signed, at least three, anonymous leaks to the ABC at the most senior of levels confirmed to the ABC what many of us had been told, that Port Kembla had in fact been selected as the site. It was the favoured site. It was a month or two later that we discovered that it wasn't much of a secret at all, as I was leaked a copy of a very public magazine called Stars and Stripes, that some of you may know as being the military magazine in the United States for all their service people. And it had an article that was pretty clear that it was going to be Port Kembla, and extended the invitation to the entire, I think it's the 7th Fleet of the Pacific. It won't be just there for submarines, they said, it's there for all of us. And by the way, this is what the place looks like: great beaches, great hospitals, great schools, and a stone's throw away from Sydney. This was in May 2022. I say this because this is the evidence that we have that they know damn well where they want to put these things. And the question remains unanswered as to whether what happened since then has made any change to their plans. I'll leave that story there for one moment and I'll come back to it at the end. But I want to now look at some aspects of what it is exactly that has been committed to. Without going in chapter and verse, I want to start with the obvious question, and that is that a change and a review of Australia's strategic posture and assets and mid and long-term trajectory, if I can use that term, that is based on a perceived threat to our national and strategic interests 30 years in the future to warrant the expenditure of at least $360 billion for technologies that the reviewers and the governments that agreed to them say they are so confident will be relevant and appropriate in 30 years' time. It is something that has not only raised questions amongst the broader community, but more importantly, amongst the military itself. And I want to start here to indicate the depth of the problem here for the government in to try and sell this with any integrity. I would never in my life have imagined that I would have been a co-signatory to a full-page ad in the Australian Financial Review with a former head of the Australian Air Force. They can label me as a troublemaker, lefty, communist, whatever they want to say from Wollongong. But they can't level that at the former chief of the Australian Air Force, who raised those very same questions publicly in a full-page ad and was told and acknowledged and accepted he didn't have a problem being a co-signatory with me and former premiers and foreign ministers and others. That indicates to you just how far the government has gone with this in implausibility. Total implausibility that those three questions about a 30-year time frame when our assets may be available to use and deploy, and the knowledge with some certainty as to the strategic situation facing this country in 30 years, much less who they perceive to be the enemies are and what their technological assets might be. And then, of course, is the killer blow, and I'd hate to use their terminologies, but this one, as the Americans say, doesn't hunt. This one doesn't hunt. The idea that you can invest so much in assets that are designed to give you the edge on the other side of the world when, and these are not my words and I certainly don't hold this view of our strategic threats, but the internal military assessments would have regarded Indonesia, frankly, as a more immediate threat. I don't regard it that way, I've got to make this clear. But their own internal threats would have regarded other places as a more significant security concern for this country than China. It is that far down the list. More than the usual weight is placed on the question of motivation. If it's not for that reason, then what? And this is where I say to people, have a look at what the publicly stated objectives and projections of the US Navy have been, frankly, since the 50s, 60s, 70s, since the domino theory, more specifically, came into being, and since Vietnam in particular. The United States Navy has always wanted a greater presence on the east coast of this country. They've made no secret of it. The question arises that if we're not going to get assets for another 30 years, what are we going to do in the meantime if this is what we need to actually fight China and deploy our assets up there? Well, the answer is very simple. It follows that the United States will have to base its assets here at our future nuclear submarine bases. That's the staging post. That's the place they go. Why? Because the Australian government will argue that we need some coverage and some defence in the meantime, and we need someone to train our own people. They've already said that. It won't happen overnight, and they need a transition period. It'll start with the training. It'll start with the preparations. It will start within a 10-year time frame, they say, which could become earlier, in terms of building a base for nuclear submarines. And if ours won't come in the next 30 years, they'll need something in there to train our submariners for the future and to build up that pipeline of knowledge, of assets, and of skills. The objective all along here has been about using and getting around the laws in this country which do not allow foreign military bases and installations. This is the objective. We may never get nuclear submarines with an Australian flag on them. I'm putting to you that with this military posture and with this agreement, there is one certainty: we will get American nuclear submarines in these bases, well before, if ever, with Australian submarines. Why do we say that? Because the Americans are already using that argument internally with Congress and their Senate, because they're finding it hard to even pass the bill that they need to authorise the sale of their existing clunkers, as I call them, and to build new ones. They need to actually pass that through their Congress. And what do they say when they're asked? Their answer is, look, we know that we can't produce enough nuclear submarines for our strategic needs and interests and our capacity. But don't worry, if we sell some to Australia, it won't make any difference because they will be ours. They are saying this right now in Capitol Hill, in their parliaments, in America, and they've been widely reported as saying that. Well, the biggest question that arises out of this is the one assurance that our Defence Minister, Richard Miles, gave to the Australian people is that whilst there's an Australian flag on top of that nuclear submarine, its chain of command will be to an Australian commander. Well, that doesn't apply if we're not going to get those submarines for 30 years, if ever, and what we're going to get is American submarines with the American flag on top. But it says something else, that those ports that we are saying it's totally safe and don't believe the arguments and the scare, you know, the scary stories and other things that the locals are telling you, it'll all be fine because they won't be nuclear-armed submarines. Well, if those submarines aren't going to be here for another 30 years, and the submarines and frigates and other things that we get from the US Navy have got an American flag, it means that they won't confirm or deny carrying nuclear weapons. So what I'm putting to you is that our defence minister cannot hold that promise to the Australian people because they will not have an Australian flag on them. Let alone the argument of even if they did, they would be under the command of the US fleet. We don't even have to go that far. We're not even going to get them for another 30 years, and they're predicting conflict with China as early as 3 years. So that whole notion of sovereignty comes into play. That is why, in our region, we have said, and I've made a point of it at every opportunity, that is why we say that when the US Navy comes in, call a spade a spade. They got no right to even call it an Australian nuclear submarine base. It will, for all intents and purposes, be a US naval facility in Port Kembla, if that's where they choose to go. And the only Australian flag will be up there for our posture. And as I said jokingly, it's probably going to be made in China, ironically. Once the US Navy comes in, they don't just take a couple of parking spots, they take your port. And as one anonymous military person told me, if they're going to send nuclear submarines to Port Kembla, and these things are designed to be invisible, the only time your enemy's going to know where they are is when they come into their home port. That is where your nuclear target comes from. I knew that much. What I didn't know, which I should have, is when he says to me, and you know what? You reckon we are going to send our nuclear submarines to you in a commercial civilian port without missile batteries and without air defences? You're dreaming. We're not here just to take your port and put our submarines in. We're here to defend our submarines. This exclusion zone is not exclusion zone within your port. It is your port. We will let you in when we want you in, and we won't let anyone else in or out. And if you think I'm joking, have a look at the recent terrible accident up in the north where those four, five kids basically went down in that helicopter. Did you notice that not one journalist was able to report anywhere near the scene. Well, did you know that they weren't allowed on the island? They had to go and report from across the water. And do you know why? Because under the agreements that we now have with the US military, they were able to exclude that whole island. What do you think they would do with 8 or 10 or more nuclear submarines? This in a harbour that is a thriving port of steel production, inputs and outputs for steel making, that is going to be the hub of our renewable technologies. That's where we're going to be ship them in, provide the steel to make the foundations and bases. The New South Wales Treasury, and this is just one port, tells us $43 billion is earmarked, not my numbers, New South Wales Treasury, in renewable investment, and all of them centred around our port. What hope do we have if it gets taken over by the military-industrial complex? These are the reasons why the local people of the Illawarra and Port Kembla and Wollongong have told the federal government that whatever else they do with AUKUS, that we're not going to let the military of the United States take our port, to take our opportunity for the jobs of the future and put a nuclear target on the backs of our entire region. That's why we say that this isn't just about conscription anymore. And I use the term purposely. This is about conscripting an entire region into the war machine of the United States. It's not just about the people directly involved. They take your port and you are left fighting for the job of servicing them. In a place like many places that's short of housing, that is short of so many things at the moment, we're going to take resources away from that to actually house and feed the US Navy. These are the real questions and the burning issues. And none, I've got to say, more pressing than two things. One, that question of sovereignty. Sovereignty not just as a national issue. We look at it as a community issue. And when it came to the fore, and the government said, I think someone said stupidly, this is Arthur's War, because I was doing my job as the voice of working people. And we said, you know what? We'll have May Day. We'll have the May Day down at Port Kembla, and we'll ask the people. If they're with us, they can turn up. If they're okay with it, you stage your own rally in support. It was the biggest May Day we've ever seen in our lives. Thousands of people filled the streets and unionists came from everywhere in solidarity. Things changed from then. The government then talked about, we don't have to make a decision for some time. And many people are telling us privately, there's no way on earth we're going to go back there. We're not so sure. Because one thing we do know, that the US military is not going to consider a May Day rally in Port Kembla, or what the Australian government thinks, or a few local politicians who might feel a little bit threatened by such a development. I know my place, I'm the Secretary of the South Coast Labor Council, but I'm the Secretary of a region that has a history of thinking and acting locally, but being part of an international struggle. An international struggle, just as our forefathers and mothers did in 1938 with Adelfram, just as we always have. That's our commitment. And all we can ask from all of you is solidarity and to do what you can to expose this blight and this dark cloud hanging over the working class in this country.